Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You are listening to Missed Apex Podcast. We live F1. Welcome to Missed Apex Podcast, AMA, in association with r/Formula One. I'm your host, Richard Spanners-Reddy, and we are an independent podcast produced in the podcasting shed with the kind permission of our better halves. We aim to bring you a race review before your Monday morning commute. We might be wrong, but we're first. Today, we're joined by F1 media star Chris Medland. Normally, he asks the questions to the top names in Formula One, but today we turn the mic on him and ask him your questions, provided by the subreddit r/Formula One. Hi, Chris.
Hello, how are we doing?
Thank you so much for taking the time in between GPs. I know the rest days are kind of getting less and less at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, as a freelancer, I don't really get rest days anyway. So it's always just working from different places. But yeah, it's cool to do. I tell you what, this is really daunting. As you said, I'm usually the one asking the questions and just sitting back and letting someone else sort of worry about the answers. But it's strange to be the other way around.
It does give you an insight into what the drivers go through when people are asking them questions and there's all this expectation on them to provide an interesting narrative. Really, they're just there to turn the steering wheel.
Yeah, that's all they want to be doing. It's although I always remember that one of the press officers who used to work at Red Bull and Toro Rosso said when he worked with the Toro Rosso guys, he'd walk in for their first meeting and say, we pay you X100,000 pounds a year, and we pay you that to do the media because you don't like doing that and you don't want to do that and you're not comfortable doing that, but you'd drive the car for free. So he said, that's why you're paid so well. It's to do the stuff that you don't like to do. So I can see where he's coming from.
And I suppose as a freelancer, expressing yourself on other platforms is part of your work as well.
Yeah, I've got to give it a go, haven't I? I'm surprised there's not been any abuse so far. I'm sure there'll be some coming, but you know, got to front up to that as well when you get things wrong.
Well, the questions were set by the moderators on a moderated subreddit thing, so I'm assuming that people behave themselves more when it's that are in charge. Thank you very much to the moderators at r/Formula One for setting this up. Let's fire into the questions. The first one is from user AnilP228. He says, if you could travel back in time and have a media pass for one F1 race from a previous era, which race would you pick and why?
Do I have to pick one race? Like, one is so hard. There's been a lot. There's been over 1,000. We know that now.
The forum is yours, Chris. You can pick as many as you want.
I know. I'm going to cheat, aren't I? I'll admit, I saw that pop up on that thread and thought, that's a really good question because it is something you don't normally think about. And it would definitely be a title decider. I think I'd love to go back to something like Japan in 76 to see Huntley Lauda and kind of how that played out. But I also look at it from the perspective of how we deal with it now in the terms of the way media is now. And you think, imagine just tweeting that Lauda would come into the pits or, you know, where Hunt was in his position and people maybe who couldn't see it suddenly thinking, wow, what's going on here? Same with Japan 89. Japan seemed to have some good races to go to. But obviously Senna and Prost and that collision and the fallout and the drama that would have created within McLaren as well. And same sort of thing, just going and chasing that because back then, I suppose there was a bit more time for it to unfold and to be covered in a considered way. But to try and do that real time, I think would have been really cool. So probably one of those two. Or if I'm allowed to cheat slightly, I wouldn't have picked them initially because people say it's not really that far back as an era. But 07 and 08, the two title deciders in those 2 years just looked incredible to be at. I really, really am jealous of people that are at those.
We're getting to the point, actually, that's starting to feel like a different era in F1 because we've got a newer generation that's come in. But you kind of cheated already by saying you would have all your modern journalistic tools available, like you want to tweet about Lauda. But in the olden days, wouldn't you have just had way more time before the rest of the world even knew what was happening?
Yeah, exactly. And as part of me that thinks that looked great, when I used to actually put in the old race reports into ESPN when we did an archive, we had like these this specific archive we were building of every Grand Prix, we had a race report. And I remember reading about them and looking up and researching them and thinking, this would have been awesome to cover the sport back then because you'd fly out really early. You could take as long as you needed to file your copy. You had days until it was needed, maybe even weeks if you're doing it for certain magazines and different outlets like that. So I thought that would be a great way to have worked. But now I find that the buzz you get as a journalist and the excitement is when something happens and you want to relay it as quickly as possible. And I think I'd probably have got frustrated that you had to wait so long for people to find out. So yeah, I think I'd rather have done the immediacy. But same thing, but when we had like the FISA Foca War and you had, you know, drivers wanted down in South Africa and that sort of thing, and journalists could go and mix with the drivers and really talk about what was going on. I think that era, that does sound really cool.
Yeah, your tweets often come out before my stream has, you know, before the event has happened. So, it's a good way to follow Meadows so that, you know, you get alerted to something interesting about to happen. All right, then. So if you had to nail down one answer for Anil here, what is the race you're going back to?
I think I'm going back to Japan 76.
You've got to imagine the parties would have been better in the 70s as well.
Exactly. You think of, you know, James Hunt's just won a world championship. I think you're going to want to be there to see. Half the reporting is going to be the morning after and the carnage that ensued. So, yeah, I think that'd be a fun one to do.
Chris, let's get on to another user question from r/Formula One. A TV in black and white asks, "Hey, Chris, what's Hello. Your best driver interview anecdote?"
So this is really tough because you do so many interviews. They do kind of blend into one. A recent one that's quite funny was I do some TV reporting for the Middle East broadcast at NBC. And I was in the TV pen with Daniel Ricciardo after the race in Hungary. And he really needed to sneeze. And we waited for about 5 seconds of him pulling his most ridiculous faces and going, and it went on and on and on. And I was in stitches, to be honest. So that was hilarious. But one that I always bring up that was really cool, that maybe people who know him and know the name, as soon as I say it, will think, yeah, it'll be hilarious. But others would probably not expect me to pick someone like this. But it's Davide Valsecchi. I did an interview with him, a feature with him when he won the GP2 championship. He was in Abu Dhabi and he was going to test the Lotus. And I did this feature with him where we did an interview and went karting at the kart track that was in Abu Dhabi.
Oh, it's a tough life, isn't it? Oh,
I know. I set this up and essentially I was like, how do I get some free karting and an interview all in one? But it was basically to use him to coach me. So it was only brief, but it was, what does a driver see if he follows you as a punter who thinks he's quite, you know, can drive a go-kart, and you get told this you can improve, that you can improve. And we went out and Davide followed me for a few laps, really tight twisty car park sort of circuit. It wasn't exactly thrilling, but it was fun, and I obviously went for it trying to impress. And we stopped for a break in the middle, and he comes over and we get the track map up, and he's like, so I won't do his accent, I shouldn't.
Go on. It's such a good start.
He's like, I hope language is fine in this, but he was like, you know, I can see, you know what you're doing, you drive fast, it's good, and then you get here and you're shit. And then we come here and you're really shit. But all with a massive smile on his face. And I was like, well, why don't you say what you mean? that was quite good. I obviously all went in the feature as well. So I have learned not to overestimate my karting abilities.
Does that count as an interview, I'm sure? Do you ever do these almost like the Vox Pop ones where they have a driver in the car and then they have a stream of journalists jump into the passenger seat and ask questions? And the drivers seem to do their best to really just frighten the journalists into not asking questions.
Well, I did. I've done two hot laps with the Pirelli hot laps they do. So jumped in when it was with Lando in China. But then last year I did Max Verstappen as well in Canada. And that came after I'd hosted the official FIA press conference. And in it, he got a lot of questions about Monaco when he'd been crashing. And a few journalists were probing quite a lot, going, you know, do you need to change? Do you need to change? And he was getting tired of it. And in the end, Max said he was going to headbutt someone if the questioning didn't change. And he was semi-joking, but there was, you know, not much of a smile on his face when he said it. Anyway, 30 minutes later, the guy that was hosting that press conference then gets into a car with the same driver who's just threatening to headbutt everyone. And I just sort of looked at him and was like, great. But no, he was actually on very good form. And he tried to scare me a little, I think, but he was pretty chilled out. And I was actually really impressed with the way that, in that sense, drivers can switch between kind of the face they have to put on and the thought process they have to put on for media and doing interviews. And then as soon as they're out of that environment, they can be totally normal and relaxed again really quickly. So no, not been too scared by too many drivers so far.
We are, of course, also streaming live on YouTube, and we're joined by a live chat room. You can jump on the live stream for any Missed Apex programs by going to YouTube and searching for Missed Apex podcast. Clappers has just made a great comment in there talking about which season you'd like to go back to with a media pass. And he says, I'd love to have seen James Hunt with a Twitter account.
Oh, yeah, that would have been carnage, wouldn't it? Someone should just set that up anyway and just do how he would have reacted to things nowadays. That must exist somewhere. Twitter's huge. But yeah, he would have been amazing on social media.
Whose Twitter account do you think would benefit most from being let off the leash of the current crop of drivers? Because they've all got to be a bit savvy, haven't they? And you see, like, Ricciardo occasionally will tweet something like, oh, I don't need to say anything. But if he was unleashed, do you think he would be pretty tweet happy?
Yeah, a little. I think it was after France, wasn't it, where he really wanted to. He said he was in danger of a Twitter rant and then stopped himself, which was almost one in itself. But I still think Lewis holds back a lot. He does have some pretty sort of big outbursts every now and then, or sometimes where maybe he rethinks what he said. But on the whole, I think he really does hold back now with the way he works that. And a few years ago, he was a little bit more free with it. But it became a news story. And I do appreciate that they don't want that either. We want the driver to be as honest and themselves as much as possible. But then when they do that, we sometimes pick up on it and make it a news story. So, I think, to be honest, I know Seb doesn't want to be part of any of that. But when you hear some of his outbursts, like in the car or when he's not happy about things, I reckon he could be really, really sarky and quite fun if he was on Twitter.
We should let him tweet from the cockpit, because when he gets out of the car, he can compose himself so well. And you go, that's not the same guy that was on the team radio. Vettel is the topic of the next question, all provided by the moderators and users of r/Formula One on Reddit. And this one is from, I'm just going to say it. The user is F1FEGP2BTCC. Snappy. Annoyed I didn't snap that up myself. Hi, Chris. Thank you and Missed Apex for doing this. You're certainly welcome. With the struggles that Vettel is facing at Ferrari, do you think that his struggles are a result of the car not suiting his driving style and perhaps the pressured environment at Ferrari? Do you expect Leclerc to suffer the same problems with Ferrari in the future and then have to move to another team to achieve glory?
I do think it's about the car not suiting his driving style. I think, in a sense, you only have to look at what Vettel went through alongside Webber at Red Bull and the way that, at that age coming in, he was very good at adapting and changing his driving style to fit the car however it was needed. And Webber couldn't quite do that. Things like the blown diffuser and needing to actually plant your foot more because it would give you better aero performance at the rear. But obviously, if the rear is loose, you're not thinking, oh, I'll put my foot down even harder. You're thinking lift because I'm going to lose it. So to retrain your brain like that's obviously so difficult. And that's what makes these guys so good. But Vettel was better at Webber than that, at doing that. And I wonder if now he's just getting to the age now, he's in his 30s, where it's just not quite happening as quickly for him. And he's learned so much about a Formula One car. He's been in it so long that someone like Leclerc, who's new and fresh, can just absorb that information and adapt a little bit quicker. Or at the very least, it's just not quite ingrained in him in the same way as it is in Seb. So I do think that does play a part because we've seen Seb perform at Ferrari. He's had some good years. Obviously, you know, when he first went there and getting wins and being the closest thing to a threat to Mercedes when Merck was so dominant, I think it shows that he can perform there. The pressure is only big if things aren't going well. And Ferrari have had a couple of years of a car that should challenge the championship and they missed out, and Seb was sort of central to that. I don't think Leclerc's going to suffer the same fate necessarily. I think it's too early to know that, but I think he's fitting in well there. He's learning quickly. I think we saw him play a few little games in Monza on certainly on Saturday. And realistically, it's such a political beast, Ferrari, that you can't be completely naive to it. And maybe he'll make some more mistakes soon, certainly in his early part of his career. But I think he's still well set that he can be successful there. I don't think he'd have to move to get that success.
A follow-up from the floor, Your Honour. It's interesting you're saying about age. It's crushing to hear a relatively young man being described as, you know, perhaps at the far end of his career. As a 39-year-old, that hurts. How old is Vettel?
Vettel is 32 now, 33.
32. Oh, that's depressing. But, I mean, that is true for an athlete. 32, you look at down the pitch or down the pit lane at a 19-year-old, and they just have a different energy that you just don't have anymore.
Yeah, certainly. And it was Vettel at one stage. You know, he came in as he talks about when he first drove that BMW Sauber at Indianapolis and thought, how am I going to do this? Like, how am I meant to race one of these things? This is terrifying. But experience sort of teaches you so much and makes you comfortable. But then once you get comfortable, it's hard to kind of adapt to new things, or harder. I'm not saying it's impossible by any stretch. And we've seen certain drivers do it very well. But I think that's also when a driver has a certain style that they're very, very strong. Look at Jenson Button. I mean, there were times that he was unbeatable because of his driving style and he was smooth in certain conditions. But there's other times he just couldn't get a car to work for him. And, you know, that's just all on style and feel and the way a driver approaches racing. And you can't just change that instantly. So it might be that Seb's finding that out a bit the longer he's gone on in the sport.
It's fascinating to watch that Ferrari dynamic change. It's possible that Leclerc right now isn't being judged in the same way as Schumacher, Alonso, Vettel. He's being judged as the young upstart coming in and upsetting the number one. Do you think he's going to be the number one by the end of the season? Or actually, this follows on nicely to Toxic Junior's question, which is, do you think Vettel can strike back against Leclerc this season? And what happens? What happens if he can't? Like, we've not seen this before. Alonso didn't get ousted by Massa. You know, it's a very different one.
Yeah, I do think there'll be races when Seb has the upper hand. I mean, until the win on Sunday, Seb was still ahead of Charles in the standings. He'd missed out on his bigger opportunities, but he's still got it in him to perform when the car's good enough and to deliver race wins. And I think Charles is still going to make mistakes as well. I know some people do question it, but if the car is quick enough at the front, I think, you know, Seb is good enough to do it. And the way Monza panned out, I mean, if qualifying had gone smoothly, shall we say, there's every chance Vettel would have been on pole, and who knows how that would have panned out from there. But I think what Seb can do is certainly still deliver that sort of result. I think just as much Leclerc can still deliver some mistakes, because it is his first year at Ferrari. He has made some already this season. We've seen it in Germany. We have seen it this season where he's made some small errors, because he's going to. He's pushing hard. He's trying to make himself that number one in that team. And in doing so, he's still going to make errors too. So I think that will open the door to Vettel a bit. To be honest, it's a good question to say what happens if he doesn't, if Vettel doesn't get the better of Leclerc between now and the end of the season. And to be honest, I think it just means it's 1 year and then it could be goodbye, because I still feel that Vettel does want to stay. He does see the potential for Ferrari to become world champions, and you know, he would be desperate to emulate Schumacher and win a title with Ferrari. But his contract runs out at the end of next season, and if he sees that he's being pushed aside right now, but he'll think, right, one last go then to hit back as such next year. If he doesn't do it then maybe he'll think the writing's on the wall. But it's a very similar scenario to what happened at Red Bull when Daniel came in and in that sense eased him out. But he had the opportunity to leave. He had performance clauses in his contract, and he had that dream Ferrari seat waiting for him as well. And he doesn't have that next thing to go and do right now. So I don't think he's going to be quite so eager to move on.
It's quite damaging to have two number one drivers when you've also got other teams involved. So if you've got like a dominant Williams or a dominant Mercedes, you can have Rosberg and Hamilton. But actually, Ferrari might look at Mercedes across the way and say, well, we've got a car to beat them this year. We do actually need to pick one of you guys, because Charles, you've come of age much quicker than we expected. Can we go to some more questions? All supplied from r/Formula One from a user, you over-rotated. Hi, Chris. What's the most important story of 2019 that no one's talking about? And well, maybe you'd already be talking about it, or do you have a secret? Do we have exclusives?
Well, this is it. I did see this and thought, if it was that important, we would be talking about it, I'd like to think. I do think it's gone a little bit quiet on the 2021 front because, you know, we don't have regulations for that yet. We don't have commercial agreements signed yet. In a sense, the sport isn't confirmed beyond the end of next year. Now, it clearly is going to continue because there's race contracts in place.
Oh, yeah.
Some sponsorship deals in place. I mean, Rocket extended their title sponsorship with Williams. Sergio Perez now has a contract to race beyond that time. There's, you know, people are committing because they know it's going to happen. But the fact that it hasn't yet maybe should be a little bit more, I don't want to say concerning, but just should be something we don't forget because it could suddenly blow up that a certain team decides, nope, not happy with where this is going. Or perhaps that more teams get to come in because they're like, yep, this really does work for us. Yeah, it could really, really open things up. So until you get it nailed down and it stabilizes, then it's got the potential to be quite volatile.
Okay. Would you mind giving us a little bit of a lay of the land of how you see how the teams are looking at 2021? Does it need all the teams to agree on these regulations or just...
No, it doesn't. But I think that's still what Liberty would like to do. Same with the FIA. They try and keep everyone happy as much as they can. And it doesn't really work. What Ross Brawn seems a bit more open to do is to just go, screw it. These are the rules. Deal with them. But he's not the one who has to worry about the financial side of things and basically keeping everyone involved in that sense. He just wants, from a sporting perspective, to go, this is going to be the best way of doing it. It's clear that they're fighting a bit of a battle in terms of the teams thinking 2021 is going to be too prescriptive with the regulations and they're going to be, the cars will be too similar. Because they even ran a competition, like a quiz called Guess the Car in Monza for journalists, which they'd already done with team members. They'd done it with F1 personnel as well. And It was taking all the liveries off the cars and making them like a gray or a black or a white color, from testing it was. And you had, sort of an oblique angle and then you had the side on view. And from those two, you had to just work out in each picture, which car was which.
How did you do?
The whole point. Well, I didn't get to do it. Sadly, I was doing the F2 press conference at the same time and that overran. So I was unfortunately unable to do it, but Lawrence Edmondson, who I sit with from ESPN, he got 19 out of 20 right. And there was one curveball in there. He thinks it might have been an F2 car now, thinking back. But they weren't told if it was every car twice or if how it was mixed up. So the odd number suggests there was a trick just to make sure no one got maximum points. But it was quite surprising that he got 19 out of 20 because I think, and everyone scored fairly highly, or a lot of people scored fairly highly. And I think F1 wanted people to struggle because their point they wanted to make to the teams was no one can tell the difference between the cars anyway until you put a livery on. So the 2021 rules won't matter. As soon as you put your livery on it, everyone will see it's your car.
They should have asked middle-aged podcast hosts and they'd have had more success, I think. 2014 would have been a lot easier, wouldn't it?
Yeah, big time. And to be honest, I think, you know, I think I would have struggled a little. I reckon I'd have been in the ballpark about 14, 15 out of 20. But at the same time, I do agree that once you put a livery on it, and there is still differentiation in the cars in the way they're designed, teams are going to chase that differentiation because it's performance. They're never going to just leave it. And fans are going to see a car that hopefully looks quite cool in styling anyway, is like a basic idea, but then it's slightly subtly different in different ways. And then you put a livery on it and it's clearly different. So I think F1's right in that sense. But yeah, they wanted to prove a point and it didn't really quite come off on them.
So just to circle back a little bit to over-rotated's question, because he's saying what is nobody talking about, do you find that there is aspects of these 2021 rules and the way it's working out and the kind of the battle of the soul of F1 between, you know, is it going to be more spec, are we going to bring the spending costs in, is there a big difference between the understanding as you have it inside F1 and say somebody like me watching from thousands of miles away? Is there something that the general public is missing?
I wouldn't have said so. I think maybe they are overlooking just how much research is going into it and how much time and effort and money is being spent by F1 alongside the FIA to try and make sure that what they come up with works. You know, it's been done so basically in the past. It's kind of an idea. And, you know, if you think of the 2017 cars, they were meant to be the fastest ever because the drivers want to be, you know, challenged more. But obviously the knock-on effect was then it's harder to follow and harder to race. And as soon as you present them, then there's some other reason that it was the wrong way to go. And I think now we're seeing F1 trying to cut off all of those avenues that might suddenly mean that there's a 2021 car that comes out and someone goes, yeah, but then that's turned it into this, or that's created this problem. They're trying to minimize how many problems it creates. So It's a huge amount of effort that's going in there. We get the odd presentation, sort of off record sometimes, sometimes on record. We get to see how it's progressing, the work that they're doing. And yeah, the investment is huge. I mean, I think they released a video recently, didn't they, of the Sauber wind tunnel, running the wind tunnel model in there. And that was very cool to see. But also shows, you know, this is, they're basically a Formula One team developing a car and sticking it, you know, doing all the testing, now trying to work out if they were a rival team, how would they screw over their rivals? They're looking for the loopholes. It's a huge amount of effort. And I think that's maybe being underlooked when people then criticize it and they go, oh, well, that's rubbish for this reason. It's like, well, there's a reason it's got there. It has been worked on a lot.
Excellent. Let's move on to our next question because it is organizational and it is related. And it looks like the moderators at r/Formula One on Reddit have actually put these in a logical order. It makes perfect sense. See, when I talk to Joe, Joe's very much into the politics and the business side of it. You speak to someone like Summers, or and they are, you know, much more into the tech side. What aspect of the F1 world interests you the most? Are you much more focused on like race day or?
Yeah, a little bit. To me, the human element and the stories you get out of that, and the fact that these are like incredible people doing incredible things in cars. And then not only that, the teams around them are also incredible, and the effort that they put in to put on this huge show for people and how relatable they really are. And I try and bridge that gap a little bit between what, before you go there, you think it's this other world. Mm. And when you get there, it kind of is, but at the same time, it is completely normal people doing, in a sense, normal jobs. But when you put it all together, it creates this amazing, amazing show. So yeah, the people behind it really fascinate me.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Dolan313 says, hi, Chris. I've a somewhat vague question. At least it's not going to be that one. Who's that press conference guy with the super long question? I saw a block of text and I thought, uh-oh, am I being done here?
Well, I want to say, I think it's Walter Costner, I think it's his name. He's hilarious. And every time he starts to ask the question, everyone sits up and takes notice.
So he knows what he's doing. He's not just bad at it. He knows what he's doing.
No, yeah, he does. And to be fair, he's asking it in English when it's not his first language. I always try and cut some slack because the amount of journalists that have to do that, Dutch journalists, Spanish, Italian, exactly, asking in English, I couldn't do it the other way around. So,
Hi, Chris, says Dolan313. I have a somewhat vague question. Though I can't find a better way to put it, do you anticipate any big surprises from Liberty's management of FOM in the next 5-odd years? Hanoi and Zandvoort aren't too shocking, although interesting in their own way. And intent has been expressed to have a second US race. But can other major moves be anticipated? Anything related to tracks, teams, drivers, payment, broadcasting, the relationship with the FIA? I think it's a vague question, but it is a good question. What are Liberty doing with our sport?
Yeah, I think the biggest change is actually going to be around the racing itself, or their attempt to maybe make it a bit more compact so that they can have more races. I mean, we've seen that it's going to be a record calendar next year, but you've still got a full, when you go there, a full 4-day weekend on site for media and drivers and certain team members. But the setup that takes, getting all the equipment there, then setting it up and then packing it all down again as well, it takes way longer. So it's a huge, huge process for them, especially when it's back to back, like we're in the middle of now. And I think Liberty are going to look at ways of trying to combine making that a shorter period or a more efficient period. So maybe even a 3-day weekend in terms of Friday, Saturday, Sunday, where you still have running all 3 days, but maybe less on certain days and different timings so that it's just a little bit more friendly to the teams. But also then that it'll open up a couple more races again, because that's where the big money is for them. And I think they're willing to do that. And Ross Brawn's hinted at it as well. They're willing to then see how they make maybe Saturday even more entertaining. Do they have, you know, qualifying races, or do they mix up that format? I think they're willing to break the structure a bit. And I think Ross actually did publicly state that next year at certain venues, perhaps they could test a different format just once or twice, just see how it works out. Make it non-championship, or essentially, you know, make it that you test a qualifying race, but it's not actually counting to that race weekend. It's just to see how it would work. I think they're willing to do that when in the past we haven't really seen that at all.
But Friday afternoons, Friday test sessions are the only things that make Fridays at work bearable, is having one earphone in, listening to.
Well, I think there'd still be some. I think the most likely way they've gone, and I've not had this, you know, there's been so many discussions about different ways that Liberty and FIA are looking at doing it, but I think it's more likely that they'd have maybe one long one on Friday afternoon, but not the morning one, or it'd be a short morning one and then a long afternoon one, but just try and shift everything back so that teams essentially can rock up a bit later. And even then, when I say rock up a bit later, we're talking that they'd arrive on Tuesday with the cars and garages to set up rather than Monday as they do at the moment. It's the amount of work it goes into building up a paddock and building up a garage and building the car to then allow the team themselves, mechanics and engineers, to show up and run it is huge. So it's just trying to give them a little bit more leeway between those, and then they can squeeze in an extra race or two. And obviously there's millions to be had in that.
Chat room's just chiming in. Othnell says, leave the damn format how it is. And Tea Time says, Liberty should allow Kimi to carry whiskey while racing to improve his aero. Othnell is probably echoing what a lot of people are thinking, which is like, don't tinker with it. We like the qualifying format. It doesn't help. The last time they experimented was with that elimination thing, and it just didn't land. I saw where they were going. How was that seen from inside, and has it damaged the chances of experimenting further?
I don't think it's damaged the chances of experimenting further. I think it's led to a bit, when I say with the 2021 regulations, the way that they're doing so much research and so much work behind the scenes, I think there's a bit more wariness now of rushing into anything. And it's that they will test something, but they'll only test it in the right environment so that they then know its impact, or if they're going to make a change, it's going to be thoroughly researched beforehand. That was painful. Within the media center, I remember being sat in watching that and just working out which cars were going to miss the cut and hadn't gone out again. Some insisting that they meant to do it, some clearly didn't, just didn't understand the format. It was a shambles, really, wasn't it? Like the way that all played out. And there's an argument to be said that if it had been left a little bit longer, maybe teams then would have got a firmer grasp on it and it would have been better. But I was with you. The qualifying format does not need changing in my eyes. And in the same way that Monza was crazy at the end of Q3, but that's once. And sometimes you get something that's a bit different with this format. So you might get someone who wants to go out early and get a lap in, or you might get everyone backing up at the end. But it's entertaining to watch.
We'll get to the next question in just a second, but there was a brilliant chat comment there that it says, track owners want Fridays, but perhaps they could scrap the F1 from Fridays and promote better F2, F3 things and have them as kind of a giveaway for people to come through the door and get into different categories.
Yeah, I mean, we do have F2 and F3 at most European rounds, and they do run a practice and a qualifying session both on Friday. So you do see a fair bit of action from them alongside the F1 stuff. And then their races are Saturday and Sunday. And I think if you look at the way MotoGP do things, the build-up with Moto3, Moto2, and then the MotoGP race does seem to be quite a good way of pulling through fairly quickly, as I said. And I think Formula 1 has learned from that with the way we do Formula 3, Formula 2. Then Porsche tends to get in between. But there's a fair bit of racing now on a Sunday morning, especially. Saturday, you get three races as well. But then, yeah, I think Friday maybe does lack a race. It lacks that excitement of a race. And there's not many venues that do get that right. In Melbourne, they do V8 supercars, as they were, on a Friday. In fact, they run on a Thursday, I think, for their qualifying. So I think promoters should be allowed a bit more freedom, perhaps, to pick the schedule they want in terms of other support races. That would be quite good, just to open people's eyes to other types of racing, but also maybe something more local, more specific. So yeah, that could be a good idea.
Our next question is a doozy. It is from Poopella. Yeah, that's clever. I see what you've done there. It's a poop joke. Hey, Chris, if you could build a house in the runoff of any corner of any track and live there for a race weekend, which corner of which track would it be? Let's say it can be in any formation through history as well, so you can undo some. Oh, it's got to be in the runoff area, you see, so it'll be in a tarmac runoff area. We'll say the house is impervious to motor cars and it doesn't affect the motor cars in any way as well.
I'd hope not. I did see this one before as well and thought that one's a really cool question. I wish I had the money for this, but it was also a tricky one because I'm a bit biased and I sort of think, well, aside from when the racing's going on, you know, where do I want to be when I need to go out for dinner or something like that? So the one that was sort of jumping to the top of my list was turn one at COTA. If you're on the outside of that, the view you've got, the circuit, you do get some incidents at turn one. You've got a great city in Austin really nearby. I'm a big fan of the US. I'm working for Racer tends to mean that I get over there quite a lot. So I thought that'd be a cool spot to be. Obviously the outside of Radeon Eau Rouge looking down at that would just be incredible. But then, you know, we've not had the greatest time there recently. So I was probably erring away from that one. I think now you said that I can have any configuration of track though, that changes things massively.
I was thinking about you being at turn one in Austin. Wouldn't you just be alarmed at cars suddenly appearing over the hill though? It wouldn't be very good for the ticker.
Well, no, but I mean, that's one of the reasons you pick it, isn't it? Because it's probably got to be exciting. Just on the outside of a really boring corner and you're just watching everyone roll by nice and comfortably, you just get sent to sleep. So you want it to be exciting. Was there a good comment there that someone?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I get distracted by this chat room all the time. It's just somebody saying, you know, Chris Medland, get off my lawn, you pesky kids, as the cars go by. You know, I'm trying to sleep here.
I'll be grumpy old man, like waving at the sky.
I suppose maybe if you could stick yourself in the Maggots Beckett's complex as well, and you just have this incredible view of cars at their highest G's and speeds.
That would be very cool. Or even the outside of Casino Square, where you just can't believe that cars don't crash there more often, or the swimming pool, outside the swimming pool section at Monaco. There's some spots there that would just be awesome, but they just feel like they're like the street circuits. You can do that anyway, really. Yeah. You can get, I was thinking like, say, Singapore, you can be in a hotel where you're right next to a corner. It's incredible. So, I might even come back to this by the end of the, by the end of this video, because you said I can have any configuration now. And yeah. I'm like, there's so many other circuits.
Stick a pin in it. I'll put a note to ask you at the end there. Well, let's move on to the next question then. And it's another naughty username. So trigger warning, mums and dads. Okay. If your little ones are listening, it's from user Beyonce_. I see what you've done. You've used for comic effect. Hi, Chris, says Beyonce_. You swore earlier, so I've got to put an explicit tag anyway.
Apologies. Yeah.
No, it's okay.
It was Valsecki's fault.
Yeah. Curse you, Valsecki. Each episode on Drive to Survive had a theme and a story behind it, with its villains and protagonists, which made for a great story, but some drivers seemed to be treated unfairly. How was the narrative determined for each episode? Did yourself or Will Buxton help provide any of the concepts?
No concepts, not from my end anyway. I don't know how Will's interviews went, but from ours, from my point of view, it was you rocked up and there was a list of questions waiting for you. You sat in a chair, kind of a bit like this. You were getting interviewed on the spot, but fortunately it wasn't live, so I could mess up and go again. But they'd come up with the questions because essentially there was a different editor on the whole for every episode. I mean,
oh really?
Multiple editors were used, but yeah, because it was such a big thing, but also trying to make sure they're all unique and all interesting in a different way, and that it didn't become too repetitive. To break it up and have fresh eyes, they had different editors on different episodes. And it would normally be someone from that episode who'd been working specifically on it would go, right, this is my list of questions that I want to get covered off because I'm telling the story in this way. So that's why a narrative came out. I think partly as well for casual fans, you're trying to hook people in. You need to tell a story. It can't just be as plain as it could be. You almost pick a side as such, and I did see there was times that I thought it maybe even went, it was borderline with how far it went. But then also that's because I see it from different eyes as well. These guys did get amazing access. They get way more access than I ever get as a journalist. They could go anywhere with their cameras and their mics and see behind the scenes. And that can then give them a flavor that maybe we don't get as journalists all the time. And you know, drivers can be clever with the way they act with the media. So I think that could have influenced it a bit as well. What I would say is there's a few times, and very few, but a few times you get a question in these interviews that we did for Netflix where they'd ask it and you could see it was quite leading because you could tell the narrative they were going to tell with that story. And some of the times you'd go, fair enough, you know, I can see what you're trying to say and I kind of agree, or you know, I see your point and you give an answer on that. But there are other times where I'd go, actually, I don't agree with that. But then by giving either a different answer or saying to them, I don't feel that's fair for this reason or that overlooks that, then it influenced a bit what they put out, I think. So they were very open to that, but obviously they were coming into it with a different set of eyes, which is exactly what was needed. It couldn't be someone who was so ingrained in the sport that they didn't really tell a story. It had to be someone who came from the outside and went, this is so cool. This guy looks like a good guy. This guy looks like a bad guy, whatever. I can see why some people were rattled by it. I did understand that. And there were a few times that you could feel it was a bit close to the line, but it seemed to go down extremely well and made it appealing beyond just our sport.
I can see why the drivers might be wary. And I'm not saying anyone on the Netflix series did this, but you can see a lot of interviewers ask a question and the interviewer knows that his question isn't going to be included in the broadcast and it's going to look like that person has just come up with that point off the top of their head. So it can be, it's so easy to misrepresent someone in an interview, especially in that manner. Dr. Vida Geim, who that sounds like a Dutch name, says Max was done dirty by that series. Do you think Max Verstappen was treated harshly? And I think Grosjean is the other person who came off worst out of that as well.
I think with Grosjean's, it was more Haas themselves, or what Günther Steiner was willing to use him a little bit at times. But understandably, Roman was making some pretty big mistakes and it was clearly frustrating Günther and the team, and they were losing points. And when that was happening, Günther just didn't hide his emotions. And that obviously then gets condensed and used in a 25, 30 minute episode, and it looks even worse. But I think there was the ability there for, you know, when Roman had a good result, that came out, or just the way Günther Steiner was incredible. But people also then understood that was his style. It wasn't necessarily just throwing Roman under the bus. It was, if Kevin had a really bad race, he would have done the same with him. Max, I can see the argument for, but I think that was more Daniel being clever. And Daniel saw this as, it was something he really wanted to be involved in. He didn't see it as a distraction or anything like that. He really engaged with it instantly. For Max, he was a lot less interested in being a part of it. Understandably, he wasn't alone. There's plenty of drivers that were like that. And so would do what was needed and wouldn't really say no to things, but also wasn't saying, yeah, come and film me here, or come and do this, come and do that, which Daniel was. And that just naturally led to way more content that was around Daniel. And he became one of the biggest storylines anyway. I mean, no one could see that Renault move coming. So that was always going to be huge. I do think there was the odd time then that the lack of access to Max coloured things a little bit. So say Austria, and there was a lot that was focused on Daniel and some cool insight with him. But Max obviously went and won the race and drove excellently. And that wasn't really referenced because there was no access to him. There was no, you know, the whole point wasn't meant to be a season review and, you know, here's how the race panned out and here's who won it. But then beyond that result, there was no access to Max. And I actually think Max himself hasn't complained, certainly not publicly. I've not heard him say a bad word about it. I think he's still not just that bothered by it, whereas Red Bull as a team are, and Christian Horner's very engaged with it, even though he knows there's times that he came across badly. And he completely understands how and why, and I think part of him admits that's because of things he said or the way he acted. Other times it's because someone else, you know, the way the storyline went, it kind of, he was on the wrong side of something. But, you know, these guys were aware enough and you know, they're high-profile athletes or personnel who are used to this sort of scrutiny anyway. And I don't think it actually bothered any of them too much. Anyone who did have a problem was able to speak, and they all got to preview it and approve it anyway beforehand.
It's okay. If anyone gets a bad impression of you in F1, you can wait a couple of years, speak to Tom Clarkson, and just set the record straight, because we all now know that Pastor Maldonado was incredible and amazing, don't we? So,
well, exactly. And he was the Ferrari driver that should have been. I mean, that would have been a 1-2 at the weekend.
But, if only someone had helped him. No one helped him. He did it all by himself.
To be fair to him, he won a race, and there were times that he was blindingly quick. So there are times I don't criticise him too much, but I think the way he's told that story, it does sound like it was probably a lot further away than he believed it to be, or no, how he remembered it.
No, not having it. If it was said on Beyond the Grid, it's true. I'm Team Pastor. Time for two more questions if you've got time, Chris. One from Flying a Spaceship says, "Hey, Chris, thanks for taking the time to answer our questions. In what space, market penetration, financial distribution, engineering, track design, etc., do you see F1 taking its next big leap forward in the way that changes how us fans enjoy the sport?"
So I guess we could say financial distribution because of the cost cap and the way that those new that new model should come in for 2021. Ideally, will just bring the whole grid closer and should hopefully mean that we're watching a sport where any number of teams can finish on the podium at least and on their day win a race. But in a sense, that is something we've had in the past. You know, you have to go back a while now, but you know, we have seen that from F1 before. I think track design is actually going to be a big part of it. It's damn expensive, but I think if you look at, there's these plans floating around for a potential venue circuit in Saudi Arabia, which we won't go into whether that's going to happen or not and the rights and wrongs, but the designs that have been shown is something that is really intriguing and interesting. But the way they want to, you know, fans to be able to, you know, watch from above, or you know, where there's going to be a roller coaster that goes over the circuit and these sorts of things, where
okay,
if you start with a blank check and you've got the space, you can create something different. And I think that that's going to start to evolve slightly in the way that they're going to try and create some circuits now that, well, in a sense, you know, I mentioned COTA, they did it there. You know, you create a huge hill for turn one and you put a spot where spectators can see as much of the circuit as possible. You're starting to build a track with not only the driving challenge in mind, but with spectators in mind as well. And I think that might evolve pretty quickly, because once one does it, then it snowballs and others are going to want to do it, or other new circuits are going to try and follow that lead. So it will just take that first one to go. But I think that could be an area of big change.
And one final question for you, Chris. Thank you very much. I know I've reneged on the time I set out that we would spend doing this.
I've already lost track.
And then I assumed you'd be too polite to say, look, you said 40 minutes, I've got to go. No, thank you very much. I'm sure you get asked this kind of thing all the time. But from user Jessage, says, "Hi, Chris, I'm beginning an F1 journalistic career and would like to ask you why you decided to go freelance, and also what are the positives and negatives about freelancing in the world of F1? Thanks in advance. I really admire your work and please keep doing what you do." Definitely a different world for journalists now than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago.
Yeah. Thanks very much, by the way, for the first part or the end of that question. I went freelance because I started working with a website that was not based in the UK. And it meant that I was going to be working from home, traveling to all the races, and there was just going to be more opportunities to do other bits of work. So when I joined them, I said that I'd like to be able to do some other bits to supplement this. And it wasn't necessarily a financial decision then, but it was just trying to keep myself kind of diverse and being able to work on a variety of things. And then kind of branched out when I left that website. That was a website called F1i. I then went and joined Racer as their F1 correspondent, but that was far less demanding on my time. And suddenly I had the freedom to do more. But the main reason I went was because you needed to get one client at least that would mean you could afford to go to every race, which was tough. But I was lucky enough that I got that. And from there, I then was going to be one of not that many people who would be on site at every event and available to work for multiple different outlets. Because for most people, the only way they can get there is because their company funds them to go. And then they've got to justify being there because the company's paying a lot. So they're working flat out so hard to justify the output of the company in the first place that they then don't have really the scope to do anything else. So it was kind of just a bit of a gap in the market, because as you say, the way that media's changed, there's so many different outlets and styles. I'm quite lucky. I get to write online. I do some stuff for print. I do some stuff for TV. I do some hosting. There's so many different ways you can work within the media realm in F1 now. But similarly, there's so many races that very few people commit to every single one. You know, people do have lives. I'm sad enough. I don't. But most people have lives away from their job. And within F1, that meant there's some people that can't be at every event. And then when you are there, you just pick up bits and bobs and it snowballs that way. So, I just kind of fell into it that way. I love the variety. I quite like working from home in between races. And then obviously you're full on when you go out to the races. It just kind of, in a weird way, it naturally happened because thanks to Racer, I got a big enough gig that meant I could go to every race, but something that allowed me the freedom to do other things. And I like to think it means I at least understand different aspects of the sport and different challenges and demands on different media as well, so that I know, you know, the way that fans consume it, but also how other journalists have to work and how drivers have to deal with other media. And it's like, I feel like I get a good overview of stuff like that. So hopefully that makes me a bit better at what I do than I was before.
Well, Chris, it's been an absolute pleasure having you in the shed. I don't think there's anyone that's got a bad word to say about you. Everyone says you're one of the nicest guys in the F1 media center. Is it gratifying to think that there's this whole generation of journalists that's coming up now who basically, they're all saying, I want to be Chris Medland. And they're saying that as much as they want to be Will, as much as they want to be Joe.
I've not heard anyone say it yet, but it will be. That's
Jesse
very...
J.
Well, yeah, that's true. Yeah. And no, it was very kind of them to say so. It's a bit strange, to be honest, because just to be the whole reason I do this job is because I love it. And a lot of people do the whole thing of, where do you see yourself in 5 years, or where do you want to go? And I don't think like that. I think I enjoy what I do now, and I want to just keep enjoying what I do. And I think that's just, if I give advice to anyone, it's that, it's love what you do. And because that puts you in a better mood. I'd like to say it makes you a happier person. It means you get on with people better. Your relationships are better. And everyone's happier that way. So yeah, no, it's cool to hear when you just said that. But at the same time, yeah, like I said about everyone in the sport, it's just normal people that are just really nice and lovely people that you get to travel around the world with and work with. And that's why I love doing it.
Chat room's confirming. Boris Mann says, I want to be Chris Medland as well. Thank you very much to the live stream for joining us. You can find us, Missed Apex Podcast. You can find all our stuff at missedapexpodcast.com, or you can find us on YouTube by searching for Missed Apex Podcast. Chris is on Twitter at Chris Medland F1. You should definitely follow him on race days. And where should people go to find your journalism?
They should go to racer.com. They should go to Motorsport Magazine and their website. They should go to Formula1.com sometimes to do some features and news for them. If they're in the Middle East, they should watch NBC Action, and I'll get in the way on the grid every now and then. There's probably a few other places too. Racer Magazine, when we do those every couple of months, I sometimes pop up. I'll tweet and post and say where stuff goes up that I'm proud of, and if I'm not, I'll hide behind and pretend I never did it.
He's everywhere, guys. Thank you very much for joining us in the shed. Please consider following us as well at Missed Apex F1 and me at Spanners Ready on Twitter. The reason we can bring you great AMAs like this is because we have the support of our patrons. Do also consider supporting us over at patreon.com/missedapex. We'll be here for a new show on Sunday, and we do a live race review show every Sunday after the race at 8 p.m. UK time, and the edited version is always ready for your Monday morning commute. Until next time, be brave, because wounds heal, chicks dig scars, and glory lasts forever. This was AMA with Chris Medland.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.